Today we're covering Joshua chapter 4 through 6. But before we get into that, we're going to do a quick review from the last time. Let's see here. And if you remember, we covered the introduction to the book of Joshua in chapters 1 through 3. As far as chapter 1 is concerned, remember that preparations were being made for the children of Israel to go into the promised land. They were only a half a day's journey from reaching the border of the Jordan River, and the preparations were being made. God told Joshua, "Go over this Jordan, you and all this people, to the land which I am giving." And God also told Joshua, at the beginning of chapter 1, he said, "I will be with you." He said, "I will never leave you. And as I was with Moses, I will be with you." How comforting words could one hear than God to say that, "I will be with you and I will never leave you." And that's what God told Joshua. Because Joshua was taking over leadership of the children of Israel. Practically 2 million people. And the transition was from Moses to Joshua, and it was a smooth transition. The last part of chapter 1 was Joshua's instructions to the officers of the people, the officers to organize the people in crossing, to prepare provisions to cross the Jordan. And then finally, at the end of chapter 1, Joshua spoke to the fighting men, the warriors from Reuben, Gad, and one half Manasseh, who had inherited their land on the east side of Jordan, reminding them of their commitment to fight with their brothers. You know, that they weren't going to relax and say, "Well, we've already got our land, why should we go over and fight with the rest of Israel?" He reminded them of that commitment, and they said they remembered and that they would help their brethren. Going to chapter 2 then, briefly reviewing that, it covered Rahab and the spies' mission. Joshua sent 2 men to scout out the fortress of Jericho, a very mighty fortress, the first one that they were going to face in the land of Canaan. They lodged at Rahab's house, but soon they were discovered by the king's agents, and Rahab was told to turn those 2 scouts in. However, Rahab hid the spies and provided their way of escape, which was an act of treason against the king, which Rahab had committed. Towards the end of the chapter, she confessed to the spies that God is the true God, which was something for a person that had been under pagan influence to realize who the true God, the great God, really was. And then finally she pleaded for safety for her family when Israel would attack. She knew that they would need that safety because that God would take care of Jericho. Then continuing on with the review in chapter 3, chapter 3 covered Israel finally entering the land of Canaan, the promised land. The ark, representing God's presence across the Jordan, and it was carried by the priests. Also in chapter 3, 12 men were selected from each tribe, but their job would be explained in chapter 4. There's just 12 men were to be selected out, one from each tribe. Then as soon as the priest bearing the ark came into the Jordan, the river waters were stopped, and Israel was able to cross over the Jordan. The last verse that we covered in chapter 3 was verse 17, Joshua 3, verse 17, which reads, "Then the priest who bore the ark of the covenant of the Lord stood firm on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan, and all Israel crossed over on dry ground, until all the people had completely crossed over the Jordan." So it was a miracle that God had performed. They crossed over on dry ground. God had parted the water so that they could do that. Now, a couple points that I want to point out before we move on to chapter 4 is, number 1, that the priests still remained in the middle of the Jordan with the ark. People were crossing over, but the priest stayed in the river until all the people, number 2, had completely crossed over the Jordan. That's something to keep in mind as we go into chapter 4. So that's where we begin today now, chapter 4 of Joshua. And this covers memorial stones that are to be set up to mark the crossing of the Jordan River as a memorial to be set up. In verses 1 through 3, we find God's instructions to Joshua. The 12 men that had been previously selected, one from each tribe, what their job was going to be. So we find that out here in verses 1 through 3. Verse number 1 of chapter 4. And it came to pass, when all the people had completely crossed over the Jordan, that the Lord spoke to Joshua, saying, verse 2, for yourselves 12 men from the people, one man from every tribe. Verse 3, and command them, saying, take for yourselves 12 stones from here, out of the midst of the Jordan, where there was dry ground in the middle of it, from the place where the priest's feet stood firm, because they were still standing in the middle of the Jordan. You shall carry stones over with you and leave them in the lodging place where you lodge tonight. So what we find here in God's instructions was that 12 representatives, one from each tribe, were to take 12 stones out of the midst of the Jordan River, where the priests were already standing in the middle of it, and carry them over to the other side of the bank of the Jordan, where they would make their camp that night. We see this phrase, carry them over, referring to the stones, because the stones become symbolic of Israel's crossing the river, a memorial of the great miracle that God had performed. And God wanted that memorial to be set up. So these are God's instructions for the 12 men to do that. Now we come to the next section in verses 4 through 7. Joshua's instructions to the 12 men that were selected from each tribe. Verse number 4. Then Joshua called the 12 men whom he had appointed from the children of Israel, one man from every tribe. And Joshua said to them, cross over before the ark of the Lord your God into the midst of the Jordan. You take up a stone on his shoulder, according to the number of the tribes of the children of Israel. Verse number 4, and here's the reason. Verse number 6, I'm sorry. That this may be a sign among you when your children ask in time to come, saying, what do these stones mean to you? And here's the answer in verse number 7, to teach the children of this great miracle. Verse 7, then you shall answer them that the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. When it crossed over the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. And these stones shall be a memorial to the children of Israel forever, as a permanent reminder of the miracle that God had done. Just like the Red Sea crossing had been done, God's miracle. Now going back to verse number 5, this phrase, cross over before the Ark of the Lord, that's a little bit difficult in the way that it's written in our English, in our King James translation. I like the New International Version translation a little better. It says, go over to the middle of the Jordan, to the place where the Ark of the Lord your God is, and take up a stone. So that's clear. And then in verse 7, it says, these stones shall be for a memorial, of course, of this great miracle, this great event in Israel's history. And God wanted it to be remembered. So what we have then in review here, what's happening, is that 12 men, one from each tribe, were directed to go back into the middle of the Jordan River, pick up a stone, and then take those stones back to the west side of the Jordan River bank, where they would set up camp that night on the west side of the Jordan River. The next section that we come to now, in verses 8 and 9, we're going to see that actually two memorials are going to be set up. Another one besides the 12 stones set up in the camp. Okay? Verse number 8. And the children of Israel, the 12 men representing the tribes, the children of Israel did so, just as Joshua commanded, and took up 12 stones from the midst of the Jordan when they went back into the river, as the Lord had spoken to Joshua, according to the number of the tribes of the children of Israel, and carried them over with them to the place where they lodged, and laid them down there. So that's memorial number one. Each one of the 12 men went back into the river, picked up a stone, took it back over to the west side of the Jordan River, where they set up their camp, where it says where they lodged, laid down the stones. That's memorial number one. Memorial number two is described in verse number 9. Then Joshua set up 12 stones in the midst of the Jordan, in the place where the feet of the priests who bore the Ark of the Covenant stood, and they are there to this day. So as the book of Joshua was being written and Joshua was talking with his contemporaries there, those stones were evidently still there. So 12 stones were set up in the campsite by the 12 men, but then Joshua took 12 stones of his own, put them in the middle of the river as a memorial. Okay, so two different memorials set up. The one in verse number 8, on the west side of the Jordan, in the campsite. And then the second one, where Joshua set up 12 stones in the middle of the Jordan River. Here's a comment from Dutch commentary. Joshua joined these men on their strange mission, and while they were wrenching up great stones from the bed of the river, he set up another pile of 12 stones in the riverbed itself to mark the precise spot where the priest stood with the Ark of the Covenant. So Joshua set up 12 stones to mark where the priest stood with the Ark, symbolizing God's presence, where the river waters were cut off, etc. Continuing on, this was done apparently on Joshua's own initiative and expressed his desire to have a personal reminder of God's faithfulness. So the Bible Knowledge Commentary is saying that Joshua apparently did this on his own accord to set up this memorial. Now perhaps God had told Joshua to do that, but it's not recorded. All we know is that Joshua did set up this memorial in the middle of the river. Okay, now we come to the next section in verses 10 through 18. And this is a review, so to speak, of the details of the crossing of the river. Verse number 10. So the priests who bore the ark stood in the midst of the Jordan until everything was that the Lord had commanded Joshua to speak to the people, according to all that Moses had commanded Joshua, and the people hurried and crossed over. Verse number 11. Then it came to pass, when all the people had completely crossed over, that the ark of the Lord and the priests crossed over in the presence of the people. So that's telling us that after the people had made their way across, and the memorial stones had been set up, etc., then the priest bearing the ark went to the bank of the river afterwards. Then another point is brought out here in verse number 12. And the men of Reuben, the men of Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh, those that had inherited their land on the east side of the Jordan River, crossed over armed before the children of Israel as Moses had spoken to them. This is telling us that the tribes from the east side of the Jordan River, with their fighting men, Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh, led the crossing of the Jordan River. They were actually out in front. Then explains how many of them, about 40,000, prepared for war, crossed over before the Lord to the plains of Jericho. Now this is important because this is showing their commitment, even though they had their land, and the rest of the tribes didn't have theirs yet. They still did their share in going into the promised land and fighting. Verse 14. On that day the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel, and they feared him as they feared Moses all the days of his life. And that's an incredible statement, because Moses had been their leader ever since they had left Egypt. Now Joshua takes over, and yet he's exalted as well. And all the people have followed him. We're going to see as we go on with this Bible study that the people are very obedient. Okay, a little bit of review here from this section. We see that the armed warriors from the east side of the Jordan led the river crossing. Not their families or their goods. They stayed back on the east side of the Jordan. The Bible Knowledge Commentary adds this. The 40,000 soldiers were 29% of the adult male population. Less than one of every three adult males. So they had the 40,000 as warriors, but many men had to stay back on the east side of the Jordan to attend to the flocks that they had, and etc. So not all of the men had crossed over. Verse number 14 then, we see that Joshua was exalted in the sight of all Israel, fulfilling what had been predicted in chapter 3, verse number 7, where God said to Joshua, "This day I will exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you." And they're going to see that in as they go into the land of Canaan. Next section then, verses 15 through 18, another review of the river crossing, continuing on. Verse 15, "Then the Lord spoke to Joshua, saying, command the priests who bear the Ark of the Testimony to come up from the Jordan." So they were standing out in the river, and Joshua made the call for them to come out. Joshua therefore, verse 17, commanded the priests, saying, come up from the Jordan. And it came to pass, when the priests who bore the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord had come from the midst of the Jordan, and the soles of the priests' feet touched the dry land, that the waters of the Jordan returned to their place and overflowed all its banks as before. Overflowing river, like in time, it came back the way it was. What a miracle that had been done. Verse 18 says that the waters returned the way that they had been before. Here's a good comment from the Zondervan Bible Backgrounds Commentary. It says, some 29%, almost 30%, of the Jordan Valley was affected by this amazing thing, by the waters being cut off by this miracle. Next section, verses 19 through 24, the campsite is set up along with the stones. Their very first campsite in the land of Canaan, the promised land. Verse number 19. Now the people came up from the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month of God's calendar, and they camped in Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. Okay, the 10th day of the first month. Going back to Exodus chapter 12, what happened on the 10th day of the first month? The Passover lamb was set aside. Preparation for the Passover, which would be 4 days later. And here we see, 4 days before the Passover, they crossed the river. And they're being prepared, and we're going to see that as we go along, to partake of the Passover. Verse number 20, "And those 12 stones, which they took out of the Jordan, Joshua set up in Gilgal as the memorial monument in their campsite in Gilgal." Verse 21, "Then he spoke to the children of Israel, saying, when your children ask the fathers in time to come, saying, what are these stones? Verse 22, then you shall let your children know, saying, Israel crossed over this Jordan on dry land. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan before you, until you all had crossed over, as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea, which he dried up before us until we had crossed over. Verse 24, that all the peoples of the earth may know of the Lord, that it is mighty, that you may fear the Lord your God forever." And we're going to find out that the peoples in the land of Canaan heard about this great event, and it made them tremble. We're going to see that very shortly. Okay, going back to this phrase, the 10th day of the first month, that's the 10th day of the first month on God. We call it Abib. 4 days before the Passover, when the Passover was set aside, when the children of Israel came out of Egypt, going back to Exodus chapter 12, and verse number 3. Their first campsite was in a place called Gilgal, and the name describes a circle. And as one of the commentators points out, perhaps a circle of stones. This was the site of their first encampment having crossed the Jordan River. And it's actually their first sanctuary as well, because God's presence was there. So it was a sanctuary place as well for them to worship God. And then we're going to see later on in the book of Joshua that the distribution of the land actually takes place from Gilgal, initially from Gilgal, which was their headquarters for a good while. So it was a very important campsite for the children of Israel. Now the purpose of the stones that we've read about, again, is to teach future generations of the miracle that took place at the Jordan. And is also, as we see in verse number 24, as a witness to all of God's power. So very important, these stones that were set up. That ends chapter 4. Now we come to chapter 5. And here we're going to see the preparation for the Passover that takes place here with the renewal of circumcision. Verse number 1. So it was when all the kings of the Amorites, the Canaanites, who were on the west side of the Jordan, and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea, heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan from before the children of Israel until we had crossed over, that their heart melted, and there was no spirit in them any longer because of the children of Israel. They were counting on the fact that because of the Jordan River being overflowed more than a mile wide, that they couldn't get across. And yet, when they found out that this miracle had taken place, they trembled in their sandals, so to speak. Verse number 2, continuing on. At that time, the Lord said to Joshua, make flint knives for yourself, and circumcise the sons of Israel again the second time. So Joshua made flint knives and circumcised the sons of Israel at the hill of the foreskins. And they had to do this in preparation for the Passover. Remember back in Exodus chapter 12 and verse 48, God said, no uncircumcised person, talking about the males, shall eat it, shall partake of the Passover. A requirement that all males must be circumcised to partake of the Passover. That goes back to when the children of Israel came out of Egypt, Exodus chapter 12. So, in order to partake of the Passover, the males had to be circumcised. And many of these were older males, too. We're not talking about young children here. A lot of them were older males. Okay. Going back to this phrase here, circumcise the sons of Israel again the second time. Of course, that's not talking about being circumcised twice. This is pointing out the fact that the first great circumcision that had taken place was when they came out of Egypt. Exodus chapter 12. Now another great circumcision is going to be taking place as they partake of the Passover in the new land, the promised land. That's what it's referring to as a second time. Might another way, a second great event of circumcision is a better way to put it. Now as we continue on, verses 4 and 5 explains that the males who came out of Egypt had been circumcised, but during the wilderness years they had not. That's why the circumcision has to take place. Okay, so let's continue on now. Verses 4 through 6, the reason for the circumcision. Verse 4, and this is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All the people who came out of Egypt who were males, all the men of war, had died in the wilderness on the way after they had come out of Egypt, the ones that had been circumcised the first time, Exodus chapter 12. For all the people who came out of Egypt had been circumcised, but the people born in the wilderness on the way as they came out of Egypt had not been circumcised. So to partake of the Passover, this had to be done. Verse 6, for the children of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness, till all the people who were men of war who came out of Egypt were consumed, because they did not obey the voice of the Lord, to whom the Lord swore that he would not show them the land which the Lord had sworn to their fathers that he would give us, a land flowing in. So the men that had originally came out of Egypt, who had been circumcised, died in the wilderness. The new generation had not been circumcised. So they had to have it done, the males. Notice this phrase here in verse number 6, a land flowing with milk and honey. This phrase is mentioned 15 times in the Pentateuch. Now we see it here in the book of Joshua. Because it was a rich land. that they were coming into. Here's a comment from the Zondervan Bible Backgrounds Commentary that confirms that it was a land flowing with milk and honey. It says this, "In particular, date honey and goat milk may be anticipated. In the early second millennium, the Egyptian Sinuwe visited this area and described it as follows. Plentiful was its honey. There was no limit to any kind of cattle." So this Egyptian had wrote in his annals that it was a land flowing with milk and honey and all kinds of cattle, etc. Lost my light. There we go. Okay, continuing on now. Then Joshua circumcised their sons, whom he raised up in their place, for they were uncircumcised, because they had not been circumcised on the way, the new generation. Verse 8, "So it was when they had finished circumcising all the people, that they stayed in their places, in the camp, till they were healed." And you can imagine there was some groaning going on as this had been done on the older males. So they had to have a certain amount of time to heal. Verse number 9, "Then the Lord said to Joshua, this day I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. Therefore, the name of the place is called Gilgal to this day." The reproach of Egypt rolled away. What did God mean by that? He said, "This day I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you." Well, God rolled away the reproach of Egypt, the shame and degradation of slavery that they had been under in the land of Egypt. The shame and degradation of the captivity had come to an end. It's history. It's in the past. Thus the name Gilgal. Verse number nine, the last part where it says, "The name of this place is called Gilgal to this day," comes from the Hebrew Galal, which means to roll, as God had rolled away the reproach of Egypt. Comment from the Bible Knowledge Commentary, "A new significance was attached to the name Gilgal. Not only was the meaning circle, to remind Israel of the memorial of stones, but now the related idea of rolling would commemorate Israel's act of obedience at the same site." So Gilgal means circle, to remind them of the memorial of stones, but also roll, that God had rolled away the reproach of Egypt, but they also had obeyed God by circumcising their males before the Passover. That brings us now to that great event in the Promised Land in verse number 10. 4 days after they had crossed over the River Jordan, verse number 10. "Now the children of Israel camped in Gilgal and kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month, the first month on God's calendar, at twilight on the plains of Jericho." So, great event, keeping the Passover in the Promised Land, in the land of Canaan. The 14th day of the first month of God's calendar, as God had instructed. Verse number 11, "And they ate of the produce of the land on the day after the Passover, unleavened bread and parched grain on the very same day." Now let me point out that I'm reading in the New King James Version, and it says they ate of the produce of the land on that day. If you're reading in the original King James Version, it says the old corn. Well, that's not a good translation. The old isn't even in the original Hebrew. So the better translation is they ate of the produce of the land on the day after the Passover, which was the first day. Verse number 12, "Then the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten the produce of the land. And the children of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate the food or the produce of the land of Canaan that year." So Joshua was focusing here in this section of scripture that we read on them eating the produce of the land and how great that was. They had been eating manna for many, many years. That's all they knew. And now, here, they're finally getting to eat of the wonderful produce in the land of Canaan. And Joshua was focused on that. So we see here in verse number 10 that They kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at twilight, 4 days after their arrival into the land of Canaan. Now remember, going back to the book of Leviticus, Leviticus chapter 23, verse 14, that they could not eat of the spring harvest, the produce, until the offering of the wave sheaf had been done by the priest. And that had to be done on the day after the Sabbath. So this particular event that took place was similar to what we had on this year, where the Passover was on a Sabbath day. Then the very next day was the first day of unleavened bread. So the wave sheaf had been done after the Sabbath. Then they began to eat of the produce of the land. And that was on the day after the Passover, which we call the first day of unleavened bread. The wave sheaf was waved. Therefore, the Israelites could eat of the new produce of the land. And we see in verse number 12 that the manna ceased on the first day of unleavened bread also, which was a new era of living off the land of Canaan. Now, a question you might have, a question that comes up quite often, I even had this question in my mind many years ago, why didn't Joshua exactly put that in there, the first day of unleavened bread, the last day of unleavened bread? Well, he didn't do that, and there's a couple of reasons that I can offer. Number one, most likely, he knew that the children of Israel knew what the days were. They had received their sermons from Moses. You know, Deuteronomy, he gave those sermons, Deuteronomy 16. He went over the Passover and the days of unleavened bread. They knew what days they were keeping. He didn't have to emphasize what days were on. That's number one. And also, number two, Joshua was focused on them eating the produce of the land and how great an event it was. And it was a great event. And something that Joshua leaves out is he didn't talk about the expressed joy of all of them eating. I mean, can you imagine after having eaten manna day after day after day, and now you've got grain and you've got things that you've never had in your life. They were probably rejoicing. Oh, how great this is. Smiles on their faces. And yet, he didn't put those particular details in there. He was already focused on the next event that was going to take place, the downfall of Jericho. So that's just a couple ideas that comes to my mind on why this wasn't spelled out. But the days of unleavened bread fits with this account. And we'll see that as we go on. Okay. Another great event takes place here in verses 13 through 15. The divine commander comes to Joshua. And this is the introduction to the very conquest of the land of Canaan. And this takes place still on that first day of unleavened bread. Okay? Verse number 13. And it came to pass when Joshua was by Jericho. Let me stop for a second. They were probably only a mile and a half or 2 miles away from Jericho, where they had their camp in Gilgal. So it wasn't very far away for him to just go over and reconnoiter a little bit. He's on his way over there. Came to pass when Joshua was by Jericho that he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, a man stood opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand. Now notice that the man here is a capital M. It's not a small M. And it's in capital letters because this isn't a man in front of Joshua. With a sword drawn. And Joshua, assuming at first sight that this was a man, went to him and said, "Are you for us or for our adversaries?" He saw this sword drawn and he's wondering, okay, whose side are you on? Here's the answer, verse 14. So he said, "No, but as commander of the army of the Lord have I come." And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, "What does my Lord say to his servant?" Okay. This particular commander of the army of the Lord, or it says original King James, was not a man at all, but it was God, the one that became Jesus Christ, that was talking to Joshua here. And we know that this is God because Joshua realized who it was and he falls to his knees and worships. And only God can be worshipped. That's why we know who this is. Verse 15. Then the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, "Take your sandal off your foot, For the place where you stand is holy. And Joshua did so. Only God's presence creates holy ground. And told Joshua to take off his sandals, and he did so. Now going back to verse number 13, we see this phrase that the commander of the army of the Lord had a sword drawn, or a drawn sword. This only occurs elsewhere in Scripture with the angel of the Lord. For instance, in Numbers chapter 22, the incident with Balaam and the donkey, the angel of the Lord had the drawn sword. Also in 1 Chronicles 21. So the angel of the Lord, the one that became Jesus Christ, holy ground being worshipped. So this was the God, the one Jesus Christ. Because worship was involved and holy ground, God's active presence was there. And we see in verse 15 that Joshua takes off his sandals. And now he awaits God's orders of what to do. And we're going to find that in chapter 6. And again, this is most likely on continuing the first day of unleavened bread. So as we go into chapter 6 now, we see the commander of the Lord's army is going, the angel of the Lord is going to give orders to Joshua. And that's where we come to chapter 6. Siege of Jericho, the last chapter we're going to cover today. And verses 1 through 7 covers the strategy for conquering Jericho. Now before I get into these verses here, let me point something out. There was an archaeologist named John Garstang in the early 1900s that did a lot of excavating in the land of Palestine to try to find where the original Joshua was. Now, having had so many years go by and so many wars and everything, a lot of the land was not like it was, you know, back in the ancient world. But he, as in his excavations, found a site where there was actually walls that had fallen down. They had not been destroyed in any other way. And that they were double walls that had fallen down. The outer wall was 30 feet high and 6 feet thick. 30 feet high and 6 feet thick. The inner wall was 30 feet high and 12 to 16 feet thick. This was a tremendous fortress. And the Canaanites were seasoned warriors. And they were set up in this fortress thinking, nobody's going to take us down. Not even the children of Israel. But they don't, God is going to, it's, so I just wanted to give you those details about Jericho here. Verse number 1. Now Jericho was securely shut up because of the children of Israel. They had heard of the miracle that took place. So shut the gates. Nobody goes in or out. None went out and none come in. Now the commander of the Lord's army, the angel of the Lord, verse number 2, says to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand, its king, and the mighty men of valor." To put it into my own words, he was saying to Joshua, it's a done deal. It's over. Don't worry. Verse number 3, here's the instructions. "You shall march around the city, all you men of war, and you shall go around the city once. This you shall do 6 days." So that's part of the instructions, and we'll see a little bit more as we continue on. So, we see that the presence of Israel has caused just Jericho to shut its gates. No one goes in or out. They're preparing for war. But God told Joshua that the fall of Jericho, in my own words, is a done deal. I've given Jericho to your hand. And then we see in verses 3, and we'll continue on with that, in verses 3 through 5, the instructions about the strategy. Verse number 3 told us that the Israelite soldiers are to march around the city once, one time, each day for 6 days. And this symbolizes a 6-day siege of Jericho. Now, this was something that was not done in the ancient world. Those other nations, when they would try to conquer a city like that, they would come up them with all their fighting forces, their chariots, etc. They would also try to starve a city out. They would surround it and stay there for months, hoping that the people wouldn't starve and give up that way. But God's instructions are, circle around it once, Do that one time each day for 6 days. This you shall do for 6 days. More instructions then, as we continue on, in verses 4 and 5. God's instructions continued. Verse 4. And 7 priests. We're going to see how the number 7 fits into this so much. God's a number of completeness. And 7 priests shall bear 7 trumpets of ram's horn on the ark. But the 7th day, you shall march around the city 7 times. Not just once, but 7 times. And the priests shall blow the trumpets. Verse 5, it shall come to pass when they make a long blast with the ram's horn. And when you hear the sound of the trumpet, that all the people shall shout with a great shout. Then the wall of the city will fall down flat. And the people shall go up, every man, straight before him. That was God's strategy. You don't have to even send one arrow into Jericho. You march around it in the manner that I tell you, and shout, and the walls are going. Okay, so we already know here from verse 4 that for 6 days, 7 priests are to carry a ram's horns, trumpets, ahead of the ark, marching with the soldiers, in the first part of verse 4. The New International Version Application Commentary adds this: in effect, the circuits of the ark enclose Jericho in a deadly ring of God's power and doom it to fall before God's power. So the encircling was a symbolic of God's power and dooming it to fall. In the last part, the climax of the ceremony of the encircling, with the troops stationed and ready, the priests bearing the trumpets are to march around the city 7 times, blowing steadily on their trumpets. And then finally, the long blast of the trumpet signals that the people are to shout, the walls fall down, and the people begin to enter the city. That was God's instructions to Joshua. Okay, now we come to the next section, in verses 6 and 7. Joshua gives the execution of the battle plan that he just received. He talks about the first march around the city, which was later on that first day. Verse number 6. Then Joshua, the son of Nun, called the priests and said to them, take up the Ark of the Covenant, and let 7 priests bear 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the ark of the Lord. And he said to the people, verse 7, proceed and march around the city, and let him who is armed advance before the ark of the Lord. Notice this word, proceed, in verse number 7. That comes from the Hebrew word abar, which is the same verb that was used to cross over the Jordan. Go over the Jordan and cross over. Proceed across. A continuation of going forward. And they are to march around the city, symbolically besieging the city in that manner. And this first march was later on the first day of unleavened bread. And the instructions from Joshua were, let him who is armed advance before the ark. So there was an armed guard before the ark and a rear guard behind the ark, as they marched daily encircling the city. Now we come to a big section of this chapter, verses 8 through 21, the sequence for conquering Jericho. Verse number 8. So it was, when Joshua had spoken to the people, that the 7 priests bearing the 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the Lord advanced and blew the trumpets, and the ark of the covenant of the Lord followed them. Verse 9. The armed men went before the priests who blew the trumpets, and the rear guard came after the ark, while the priests continued blowing the trumpets. Now, can you imagine those soldiers in Jericho watching all this happen? And they're going, they're probably saying, what is going on here? We were expecting them to start, you know, launching arrows and spears, and here they are circling the city and blowing trumpets. We would say in modern vernacular, what's up with that? Verse number 10. Now Joshua had commanded the people, saying, you shall not shout or make any noise with your voice, nor shall a word proceed out of your mouth, until the day I say to you, shout. Then you shall shout. Verse 11. So he had the ark of the Lord circle the city, going around it once. That was on the first day. Then they came into the camp and lodged in the camp. And that was on the first day of unleavened bread. They did that circling around there to the camp and spent the night. Here's a comment from the Bible Knowledge Commentary. It was perhaps a little after dawn when a long procession began to unwind out of the camp of Israel, when they would begin this process of circling around the camp. And verse number 11 stresses that they go around at once. Bible Knowledge Commentary. Jericho, in that time, covered about 8 or 9 acres and required less than 30 minutes to march around. When the circuit was completed, to the amazement of the Canaanites, who probably anticipated an attack, the Israelites quietly returned to camp. So again, that first day, they circle around, they're quiet, and they return to their camp. And the Canaanites are probably scratching on their helmets. What is going on here? Verse number 12, continuing on. And Joshua rose early in the morning on the next day, the second day, and the priest took up the ark of the Lord. Verse 13, then 7 priests bearing 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the ark of the Lord went on continually and blew with the trumpets, and the armed men went before them. But the rear guard came after the ark of the Lord while the priest continued blowing the trumpets. Verse 14, and the second day they marched around the city once and returned to the camp. And in the summary, so they did 6 days, just like God had told them to do. Now, what I find amazing about this is, remember the story, going back to the book of Numbers, etc. The children of Israel liked to complain and they liked to grumble, didn't they? I mean, when anything went sour, complaining and grumbling and murmuring. Here, they're told to do something very out of the normal, to circle around the city, you know, in this particular manner, rather than attacking. And they were completely obedient. No complaining. No grumbling. And I think that's a lesson in itself. Here they knew something, a great event was taking place. God was with them as they had crossed the River Jordan. And now He would be with them. It was like, yes, sir. And that's something we got to keep in mind as we go forward as well. Okay. Here's a Bible Knowledge Commentary about this phrase, so they did 6 days, again without questioning. Bible Knowledge Commentary. This same procedure was followed for 6 days. No fortress had ever been conquered in this fashion. This strange strategy was probably given to test the faith of Joshua. He did not question. He trusted and obeyed. This procedure was also designed to test Israel's obedience to God's will. And of course, they complied, and very willingly. Now we come to the seventh day. The seventh day, the last day, is not marked out here in the scriptures, but it fits with everything that was happening. Verse number 15, I'm reading this wrong. But it came to pass on the seventh day that they rose early, about the dawning of the day, marched around the city 7 times in the same manner. On that day only, they marched around the city 7 times. Completeness. 7. Seventh day of unleavened bread. Verse 16, and the 7th time it happened, when the priest blew the trumpets, that Joshua said to the people, shout, for the Lord has given you the city. The Bible Knowledge Commentary points out that the procession around the city 7 times probably took about 3 hours time to do that. Another commentary from the Bible background, Zondervan Bible Backgrounds Commentary, it says this, the 7 days of marching around Jericho are identical to the 7 days of Feast of Unleavened Bread. So even a lot of commentators recognize that this fits with the days of unleavened bread, even though it's not specifically marked out here in the scripture. And then in verse 16, the phrase, shout for the Lord has given you, another comment from the New International Commentary of the Old Testament. The very first city of the Promised Land was to be Israel's by a mere shout, raised at the command of Joshua, the Lord's servant. Not by swords and not by spears, but by a shout. The city was taken. Now the next section that we come to here, in verses 17 through 19, was most likely inserted by Joshua. It kind of disrupts the events that were taking place. But he points out something very important here that had been told to the children. Verse number 17. Now the city shall be doomed by the Lord to destruction, it and all who are in it. Only Rahab the harlot shall live, she and all who are within her house, because she hid the messengers that we sent. Remember that we talked about this in the Bible study previously, that the Canaanites were terrible, terrible pagans. They did all kinds of atrocious things. They burned their children to the fire, to the pagan gods. Adultery was very commonplace. There was a lot of different things that they deemed a pagan religion. And God told Israel that they are to be destroyed because of their atrocities, etc. But only Rahab was to be spared. Verse 18. And you, by all means, abstain from the accursed things. Now the accursed things here are the spoils. Speaking of the silver, the gold, etc. That's going to go into the treasury. Abstain from the accursed things, the spoils, lest you become accursed when you take the accursed things, and make the camp of Israel accursed and trouble it. And here's the reason in verse 19. But the silver and the, that's the spoils, the accursed things, the silver and the gold, the vessels of bronze and iron, are consecrated to the Lord. They shall come into the treasury of the Lord. So the whole city was doomed for destruction by God. And Jericho was a symbol of sin. Very fitting to fall in during the days of unleavened bread. Sin, Jericho being a symbol of sin in its fall. The accursed things, again, are the things devoted to God, the spoils, the silver, the gold, etc. Comes from the Hebrew word harem, which means to God. And Companion Bible adds this, probably because they were the first fruit of the conquest. The silver and the gold, etc. And God had, Joshua made it plain that they were not to partake of these things because they would become accursed by doing that. So the instructions are plain not to take the spoils from the city, or they would share in the curse as well. Now verse 20 returns back to the action that was actually taking place. Verse 20. So the people shouted when the priests blew the trumpets. And it happened when the people heard the sound of the trumpet that the people shouted with a great shout, that the wall fell down flat. Then the people went into the city, every man straight before him, and they took the city. Verse 21, and they utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, ox and sheep, and donkey with the edge of the sword. Again, because of their atrocities, etc. So the wall fell down flat. Verse number 20. Jericho was a symbol of sin, and it was fitting that it falls on the last day of unleavened bread. Symbol of the victory over sin. Verse 21. This phrase, utterly destroyed. Here's a comment from the New International Commentary of the Old Testament. This curse, the Hebrew harem, meant that something or someone was absolutely and irrevocably consecrated so that it could not be redeemed. It also meant that the object or the person was sentenced to utter destruction. Deuteronomy 13, verse 16. Both connotations are intended here. We're winding down here now in the chapter. We come to the part where Rahab is rescuing this battle. Verse 22. But Joshua had said to the two men who had spied out the country, go into the harlot's house, and from there bring out the woman and all that she has, as you swore to her. And the young men who had been spies went in and brought out Rahab, her father, her mother, her brothers, and all that she had. So they brought out all her relatives and left them outside the camp of Israel. So just as had been promised to Rahab, her and her family were spared. Verse 24. But they burned the city and all that was in it with fire, only gold and the vessels of bronze and iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. Verse 25, and Joshua spared Rahab the harlot, her father's household, and all that she had. So she dwells in Israel to this day, because she hid the messengers who whom Joshua sent out to spy out Jericho. So this is proof that the promise was fulfilled for her family and her to be saved. Okay. So they were. Oh, I want to point out here in verse number 23 that it says her and her relatives had been left outside the camp of Israel. Here's a comment from the New International Commentary of the Old Testament. The reason why Rahab and her family are assigned a place outside the camp of Israel lies in the ceremonial uncleanness. Now going back to the book of Leviticus, somebody that's ceremonially unclean has to stay out of the camp. Aggravated in this instance by the curse to which they would ordinarily have been subject. So they had to stay outside the camp for a certain period of time before they could come in. And verse 25 tells us that she dwells safely in Israel to this day, to confirm the account that it happened. Now we come to the end of the chapter, the last verses 26 and 27. Then Joshua charged them at that time, saying, "Cursed be the man before the Lord who rises up and builds this city, Jericho. He shall lay its foundation with his firstborn, or at the cost of his firstborn son, and with his youngest he shall set up its gates, or at the cost of his youngest as well." So Joshua was saying here that this city could not be rebuilt as a fortress again. What we find out in later history, in Judges, in 2 Samuel, etc., that Jericho was built as a habitation again, where people lived, but it wasn't a fortress. And that was Joshua's point here, to not build it up again as a great fortress. Verse 27, "So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame spread throughout all the country. And all the Canaanites would begin to fear, because mighty Jericho, the very first fortress, had fallen by these unconventional means." Okay, let's see, we'll finish up here with a couple comments. A curse is pronounced on anybody that defies and renders strong the city that had been destroyed. But as I mentioned later on in Judges and Samuel, the people used the site for just a living place. It wasn't a fortress anymore. In verse 27, we see the phrase, "So the Lord was with Joshua." Here's a good comment from the Bible Knowledge Commentary. "The secret to success at Jericho was not Joshua's military genius or his army's skill in warfare. Victory came because he and the people fully trusted God and obeyed his commands." God and obeyed him. And that's how they obtained their victory. We'll finish up here with some lessons like we always do. First of all, Jericho was heavily fortified, had an abundant supply of food. That's something else that I forgot to mention, was this John Garsting, the archaeologist, found in the remains that he discovered huge jars full of grain. Many, many, many storage bins of grain that they had stored. They could have held out for months, but they didn't need to. 7 days is all it took. So Jericho was heavily fortified, had an abundant supply of food. It would have normally taken months or years to subdue it by conventional forces and methods, but it fell after 7 days. And how did it fall? By means of God's power. God took it down. Another lesson, Jericho was a symbol of sin. It took place during the days of unleavened bread. And as I pointed out earlier, it was destroyed on the last day of unleavened bread, a fitting symbol of the ultimate victory over. And that's the end of the Bible study today. This section has a lot of richness to it, a lot of important history, a lot of important lessons to be learned, and especially about trusting God and His power. And that's it, unless anybody has any questions or comments.